Welcome to the Salem Emerging Leaders Podcast, presented by the Salem Area Chamber of Commerce. Here are your hosts, Jacob Espinoza and Zachary Zalicki.
Jacob Espinoza, what did you think of my boy Garrett Cudier?
That was an incredible episode. I feel like we've talked to some amazing people, but I really think I learned more in that episode just because his depth of knowledge around the economy is just, and Oregon's economy specifically, is just phenomenal.
What are some of the biggest takeaways you had? Like, what are some things that we talked about that kind of blew your mind and, you know, in the entire discussion?
I think his ability, just being his life's work, you know, with focus on the economy, is his ability to connect the dots between different things and how there's this domino effect. But I think also I appreciate his transparency around, like, we're not exactly sure how this is going to play out. If you think of behaviors changing because of people working at home, people just being used to being at home more often. So I appreciate that about it as well.
Absolutely. One of the real fascinating things too, that I think everyone's going to be, you know, really fascinated to hear about, is when he talks about, you know, cryptocurrency, what's the future of it. And as a guy who, you know, is very, very knowledgeable in the realm of trading and, you know, just economics in general, and hearing his breakdown of what cryptocurrency, you know, can be, and, you know, kind of talking about some regulations could be good. And that's a really interesting, you know, kind of opinion on that, because there's a lot of people like, once this gets regulated, like, everything's just going to go, you know, go down. But he has a different view on it. It's interesting.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. Enjoy the episode, everybody.
We are back at the Salem Emerging Leader Podcast.
It's a new one every time. It's good, though.
That's probably
a little jingle.
It's like top five. That was a top five performance. That's top five. Yeah.
I still think our number one's the Salem Boy thing.
That was. It's the Salem Boy.
I still have my friends that like say that in my group chat. They all listen to it, which awesome. Is cool. But
those are the five people that listen to the podcast. Zach.
Yeah, I mean, five of the many.
I love it. No, I love it.
We're growing. And I think this podcast is the one we're doing right now is going to get a lot of listens, because we have one of the smartest dudes I've ever met in my life.
And Garrett, Zach knows a lot of smart people. Like, you have a really good circle of people in your life.
He's at the top, man. Like, he's way up at the top.
Well, this is quite the setup, fellas.
It is. I mean, and I feel like I'm still underestimating, like, how smart you are. And I don't mean to, like, really, really toot your horn. I know it's those compliments kind of get uncomfortable sometimes, but you and I have been talking about doing a podcast like this for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I met Garrett, oh goodness, last summer, I want to say.
I think that's right.
At Ritter's, they had a group of guys together, and I want to say Josh brought you in, or was it Jordan?
It might have been Scott even.
Oh, it was Scott. It was, yep. Scott, yeah. Invited you to come and talk, and we just got, like, super heavy into, like, national and international economics. And we talked about COVID, talked about inflation wasn't a huge issue at the time,
right.
But you know, the change in consumer habits and spending, and you kind of projected, like, well, I see this coming down the pipeline, and you brought up inflation at the time, and you've been spot on. So
I'm just imagining Zach being like a kid in the candy store during this conversation.
Oh, dude,
because
I was.
He's usually the person that's teaching about these topics. So to have somebody that is just even more well versed than he is.
Oh, it was literally like getting a high level, like, course at like a university.
Yeah.
Like an upper level course. My mouth is just open the whole time. I'm like, dude, this is nuts.
That's awesome.
Be fair on that inflation call, I thought it'd be a problem. I didn't think it'd be this problem.
Well, I've
certainly gotten a little out of control.
A little, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Garrett, I mean, can we do a quick little introduction for you so our listeners know exactly who you are too?
Yeah, sure. You know, I'm born and raised in the area. I grew up kind of in the farmland between Staten, Almsville, and in Salem. So grew up really going to school in Staten area, St. Mary's, Regis, and then ended up graduating in Blanchette here in 2000. So I just turned the ripe old age of 40. So now I actually get to complain about my knees and my back, and it's legitimate.
Now.
You can't say I'm too young to say that anymore. So after graduating high school, I went on to Oregon State. Really had a good time down there. Spent 5 years. Got 2 degrees, finance and accounting. I've always been interested in markets and kind of, you know, what I do today, just because of the challenge and the complexity has always been fun. You never know what you're going to wake up to. And that's more so in the last 2 years than I think I've ever thought it would be. But out of school, I ended up going the accounting track. So I got my CPA and went for work at Deloitte & Touche out of Portland. Kind of did the big four financial statement audit, you know, a financial statement thing for a while. Loved the firm, loved the people, didn't love the work. And the reality was it just wasn't that same challenge of not knowing what you're going to wake up to every day. So about 3 years after that, I wanted to kind of pivot. And believe it or not, I never knew that my career would take this direction. My wife worked at Oregon State Treasury at that time, and she said, you know, I think you got to check this out. You know, these guys are investing all over the world and got all this money to look after at the pension fund and state and local government money. And I think this is what you'd like. And so sure enough, yeah, that was right. I didn't want to move to New York or San Francisco. I'm not a big city guy. You know, I grew up in the farm area, and that's still kind of where my heart is. So yeah, I went to work at Treasury for a while, initially an accounting job, and kind of had to prove myself. And that's where I got my CFA or Chartered Financial Analyst designation. Then through a series of retirements, I just kind of had the keys of a very large fund thrown to me kind of surprisingly early in my career. And so I started looking after what's called the Oregon Short-Term Fund. It's a $20, $30 billion kind of multi-sector fixed income fund. It basically, it's the state and local government's checkbook.
Okay.
Right. But it's a little bit higher octane than the typical checkbook because we don't need all the money tomorrow. So we got to play around quite a bit with that. And then I slowly got into the pension fund and even managing, you know, locally here, SAFE, the State Accident Insurance Fund. We looked after their money there as well. So a lot of depth and breadth of knowledge that I got from there. That was a great experience. So I did that for, 12 years. And then 2 years ago, just what a time to switch careers and everything right before COVID. So at the beginning of 2020, I joined the firm I'm at now. So I took the role of chief investment officer and I'm a principal, one of four owners of a firm called Government Portfolio Advisors. So in a nutshell, we manage government money, right? Whether it's cities, states, counties, water districts, transit districts, et cetera. It's almost entirely fixed income, high quality. We help them look after liquidity and kind of manage the risks that we're kind of talking about now. And boy, what a time to join. You know, mm-hmm. I'm still pretty young in the industry at this age, especially that role. But coming in and being basically introduced to all the clients, then jumping straight into March of 2020 was unique for everybody at the table. And those were some scary months there for sure. And I guess that's just where we are. That's a little bit of how I got here today.
So I'm trying to envision this role. So are you making recommendations as far as like what the government should do, or what does that process generally look like?
Yeah, so it's very much a customized approach. You know, we say service, not product. You know, we're a partner. We really mean that. We're not just going to shove you into a large fund and kind of commoditize you. So we really spend a lot of time understanding really what is your position, what is your cash flow variability, what are your contingencies, what are the projects you have, and what's the variability around those things. Because if you can't solve for liquidity first and make sure that you have that planned, then we can't really invest for the long run and try to optimize your returns and maximize your money. But then the flip side is if you get too aggressive with that, mm-hmm. and you get caught up in a market like we've been in the last 12 months, especially in the bond market, you know, if you get upside down and you need to start liquidating at losses, that's very painful and clearly not a position in the public fund. So that's really what it is first and foremost. And after that, yeah, we really get into the markets and really try to think about what should we be doing here and what are the opportunities and risks and kind of how do we navigate? How do we build a portfolio and strategically and then tactically, given what we face, what are we going to do? And mm-hmm. how do we communicate that to clients and get them on board? I'd say that's the biggest role.
So what has it been like these last 2 years looking at government funding?
It's absolutely wild. I would say things were pretty stasis when I jumped in the beginning of 2020, and maybe this will kind of dovetail well into the economic talk, but you know, everything was hunky-dory. The unemployment rate was low. Jobs were reasonably plentiful. Inflation wasn't a concern.
Interest rates were super low.
Yeah, historically speaking, yeah. They were low. You know, the Fed had raised rates to 2.5-3% kind of area, and they realized that was a little bit too much. And so right before COVID, they kind of backed down to, you know, 1.75-2%. And that felt like where we were going to hang out. That felt sustainable for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But then 2 months later, you know, we were back at zero and truly an economic free fall there in March, April mm-hmm. of 2020, which was frightening, especially given the responsibility we have. And you know, we look over about $12 billion of assets. And first thing that went through my head is, oh my goodness, are we going to go Europe and Japan here, right? Are we going to go negative rates? You know, it wasn't until the last few weeks, really, that even Germany's 10-year bond yield had reached positive territory.
What does that mean for people like me that don't know what you're talking about right now?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, even if you have very low inflation, if you have negative interest rates, especially in our industry, you know, we can't just jump to stocks. This is operating funds and very conservative type of needs and driven by statute. So we were really bounded into investing in kind of shorter dated 5 year and in high quality bonds. That was my biggest risk, was if we do what has been going on since, you know, 2014 and 2016 in Japan and Europe respectively, is they went to a negative interest rate policy. And they've held it there. You know, they may change that stance, especially Europe might do it this year. But that's really painful for fixed income investors, because you just, you know, inflation always erodes your spending power. Mm-hmm. Even if it's low, it's still doing that. But then if you have negative interest rates, it just explicitly is chewing into your money. So you have this, I either need to hurry up and spend it, or I just have to accept the fact that, you know, my purchasing power is just visibly eroding in front of me. And that's just that's a tough communication. That's a tough thing to manage around. Right, because your incentive is I need to maximize mm-hmm. my term and get as much yield as I can now in order to sit on it, but that balances the, if you have a quick rebound, which we did, and rates shoot back up, it's painful the other direction as well, right? So that was really I think the biggest challenge in March, April, May of 2020.
And then we've seen inflation, and you kind of before we started recording, you'd mentioned that you knew it was going to be a problem, but it's a different problem than you anticipated. Can mm-hmm. you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. So you could see it coming for a variety of reasons. One was just stimulus, right? Just to put a quick number on it, we put $5.8 trillion of stimulus within a 12-month period in America, and the economy is $23 trillion. That's just a gigantic impulse. You know, that's World War II type of spending, except it wasn't directed on equipment and war capacity. It was jobs,
which would equate to jobs, right?
Yeah, it was handed out largely to people mm-hmm. And governments and businesses. So a very different impulse. So that was certainly it. But also, you know, just mathematically, we knew inflation would rise. I still have the screenshots on my phone, because at one point in March of 2020, the front month delivery for oil futures contracts was deeply negative. You know, they were paying you to take a barrel of oil because there was just no capacity. It was coming down the pipeline. It was coming in off the offshore, but nobody wanted it. Right, we all just stopped moving for a while, for lack of a better term, and so those were scary times. So you knew that eventually oil would be positive, right? And as well as just some of the outright deflation we saw early on, whether it was rents or goods prices, yeah, you know, eventually, you know, we will solve this, or we will work around it, and that would come out. But really, I would say that the one thing that I didn't see coming, and why I think inflation is much higher, is we never really reopened the economy, right? Whether it's policy choices or fear of the virus or, you know, variety of reasons, lack of good childcare, that's been an issue as well. If you didn't reopen the economy, consumers couldn't engage the services sector, which is 70% of the economy. It's much more flexible. Mm-hmm. I always have to remind people when talking about inflation, if you run a bar downtown Salem here and it gets really busy, it's pretty easy to open another bar compared to making a new car plant or an Intel foundry. You know, these are mm-hmm. $20 billion 3 year projects, not 6 months and tens of thousands of dollars types mm-hmm. of projects. So the consumer was never able to flip spending back from goods, which was all the rage, you know, in the COVID lockdown. Mm-hmm. In fact, here's another kind of fun way to look at it. We flipped our goods spending and services spending by about 5%. So typically it's a 70-30 mix. Okay. It went to 60, you know, to 65-35. And that's a $1 trillion pivot, right? And so people sat at home.
What are those numbers?
Well, roughly speaking, if you look at consumption's roughly 70% of the economy. And within that, two-thirds of it's approximately services, one-third goods.
Okay.
But those pivoted about 5% in each direction. Because again, you handed out money to people when they couldn't engage the services sector or mm-hmm. were fearful to. Mm-hmm. So what'd they do? They went to Amazon.com. They went to Walmart.com. They bought stuff. Yep. Right? Stuff. Camping gear, golf clubs, washer, dryer, new computer.
You look right at me and you say golf clubs.
Yeah, I look at you because I know you have some shiny new golf clubs.
I heard
clubs. People
bought liquor and marijuana as well.
Liquor store stayed open.
They did all right.
they did very well, right? But when you have supply chain constraints naturally because people are getting sick mm-hmm. and not showing up for work in these facilities, and that ripples through these what we now know to be fragile supply chains, but also just you have consistently higher demand. This is the first recession where incomes went up, right? So people had more money than pre-COVID, couldn't engage the services sector, which is the much larger, more flexible side of the economy.
And can you elaborate too for our listeners, when you say services sectors, you're talking about You're talking about bars, restaurants, those type of services?
Haircuts,
all of those. Okay.
Travel, leisure.
Gotcha.
All that hospital conferences, yeah. Business travel, mm-hmm. all of that, right? It kind of the way is outside of housing, that the adage is if you could drop it on your foot and it hurts, mm-hmm. it's a good, right? I mean, that's just the basics.
And again, you said that shift was roughly a $5 billion shift?
No, about $1 trillion
shift. Or $1 trillion,
right? Is that globally or is that in the United States?
Mostly in the United States, but somewhat in other developed nations. Let's just be clear. India and Mexico, for example, can't afford to do stimulus. Mm-hmm. You know, we can because the dollar is the reserve currency. We can punch out debt. The Fed bought almost all of it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the Fed bought about $5 trillion of the $5.8 trillion that we've kind of issued to fund this. So, not every country has that luxury. And, you know, there's a theory that maybe in the future we don't, right? But that put an immense amount. If you look at what's driving inflation today, it's almost entirely goods. Services has picked up a bit, especially in the last few months because we've had people engage services more, but the labor story is now a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so costs have gone up there. And I think there's also just some latent cost buildup for anybody operating that sector around cleanliness, you know, protective equipment, regulations around that. It's more costly to operate these, as well as there's been some inflation, you know, the inputs of food and mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. what have you. Those have gone up some as well, but 80% of it's been in goods. And so the real theory and why, you know, full circle here, why I thought inflation wouldn't be an issue, but not 7% the headline, maybe 5%, and we'd already be looking at coming down now, is people would repivot back to services more fully and away from goods. And we're starting to see that now, but it's taken way too long.
Is there pockets of it too, based off from like a state policy standpoint? Like when you have more stringent regulations in some states opposed to other states, is that, so like you look at a place like Florida or mm-hmm. Texas, where it's like everything's completely open, right?
Right.
Do you see that transition's happening to the service-based sector quicker there because it's easier in a way for people to go out? Those maybe the cost and the concern of a lot of consumers down in those states don't worry about that. But in other states like Oregon, California, Washington, or like New York City, for example, there's a lot more like heightened fear and more regulations. So is that kind of is it a state by state issue?
You know, I'm not too sure at the data level. I would assume that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't really look at the state by state data to really ferret that out.
Okay.
Yep.
Is there a thought that we don't go back? Because I'll give context to the question. So a lot of people are working from home now
mm-hmm.
and they're buying a lot of stuff. And I feel like some people are like, you know, if I don't eat out at the restaurant, I can buy more stuff. And if I don't pay for these services, I can buy more stuff. Like, is there a thought that like we just don't really get back to that heavy focus on services?
Yeah, no, that's true. I think the longer this plays out, and I think that's another thing I'm rethinking through right now, because I would argue that the longer this plays out, it's been 2 years, right? Originally, we thought this would all be a few weeks or a month. It's 2 years. Patterns of behavior change. I've always said that the economy post-COVID will be different. We have no idea how. But there is a real risk that this inflation could last a lot longer because of what you mentioned. If there is just a natural propensity to spend more on goods going forward than services, absolutely. Because building capacity, no one's really thought much about building serious capacity to solve for that $1 trillion shift. And that's just here. Of course, Europe and Canada and other wealthy nations have had a similar pivot to goods for the obvious reason that same reasons. But if just some of that sticks around, we need to rebuild capacity, and that takes time, right? And then now you have the political and the policy issues come into play, because President Biden and the Democratic Party are in serious trouble with this, and the Republicans would be too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a political statement against a party or for a party, but had they been in office in full control, they'd take the blame for it too, rightly, wrongly, whatever. And same with the Federal Reserve now, right? The policymakers now have to do something, because you can't just sit by, because there is the risk that it keeps going and it becomes embedded, and that's their fear. If people get used to 5% wage increases and 7% price increases, well, psychology says that, you know, inflation is usually a psychological matter after a while, right? Monetary impulses can cause it, you know, money supply growth, stimulus checks. Those could be temporary, but we're starting to see wage growth pick up. And if people get used to it, you know, it's a self-perpetuating thing. And that's really what they're fearful of at this point in the cycle.
I think it's what maybe adds to it. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on people working from home, because you're already at home.
Mm-hmm.
I talked about this yesterday in the summit. I've talked about it on a few occasions, but previously, like, people would get out because they had to go to work. And so you had this community in your office, you leave your home, you go park your car, you probably go get lunch somewhere.
Yep.
But now you don't have that. You're at home, you work, you're ordering Uber Eats to get your phone, to get your food, you watch Netflix for your entertainment, and then you go to bed, and you don't have that sense of community. But I'm curious to think from an economic standpoint, like, what are some potential impacts of that change in behavior?
Yeah, I mean, you hit on it. The big one there is just what we call the office economy. Now that I look back at it, I think the worst industry to be in now is like dry cleaner, right? Or, can you just imagine, you know, there's data from the card scan companies, you know, when you scan yourself into your office building, and they show that whether it's New York, San Francisco, or the big metros, it's somewhere between 30% and 60%, you know, return rate of people going back to the office even today, 2 years in.
Wow.
And so to your point, the coffee shops, the sandwich shops, they were built to handle 90-100% capacity. Right. And that's got to, if this is a durable thing, which I think, I don't know, is it 100% durable, 10% durable? Some piece of this will be durable. We're not going back to 100% is my view.
Yeah.
Right. Work from home will be a thing. Hybrid work's a thing. Right.
Do we have data on the percentage of people that are working for companies out of town?
No, too soon for that. But okay. Certainly the anecdotal is there's a lot of fight for talent. And there's a lot of, especially kind of the more, oh, how do I say this? Kind of the more technical jobs where it doesn't really, you're not reaching out or seeing a client, touching a client, right? Computer coding or even my job to a degree. A lot of this can be done from virtually anywhere. You have a good stable internet connection and a time zone that can allow you to operate. So yeah, absolutely.
Because on that note, like, I've been really having a lot of conversations on how do we make Salem an attractive place for people to live if you work for Facebook or Google or you know, just some place where you can... You make a great income, but you can come here and $100,000 is a lot of money, because if you're living in Seattle or San Francisco, you can't even survive with that.
Right.
But
right.
How do we make this place attractive? Maybe not necessarily relevant to this conversation, but like what do you see being the return on investment of somebody like that moving to a community?
Yeah, I mean, it just comes down to the network. I think so many people, you know, especially kind of our generation, have been growing up around these hubs. Right, Silicon Valley or the tech forest in Portland or the financial system in New York. I think those are going to be hard to break up, but you're seeing it. You know, I mean, I deal a lot with folks in New York and they're moving to Florida, they're moving to Tennessee. Mm-hmm. They're starting to leave those higher cost of living areas for a better lifestyle in their view. I think that's going to open up a lot. I think that is a net tailwind to rural America because, for example, like rural Oregon never really recovered. The state economist here, Josh Lerner and team, they have some great stats and you should actually get him on the podcast. He's wonderful.
Josh is, we've had him on our forum speaker series. Josh is awesome.
Oh, he's a great guy. Yeah, he's very knowledgeable.
Yeah.
I pretend to be an economist. He is an economist. So he always talks about how after 08-09, rural Oregon never recovered, right? It was kind of the brain drain, so to speak. They would go to Portland, they would go to Eugene or to Salem or leave the state. And now we're starting to see the reverse of that. Because now a lot of people, like I grew up in the country, you know, that lifestyle still appeals to me while I'm relatively young and can handle that workload. But that's kind of fun to think, wow, I can live in more places. So I think that is a tailwind to probably Oregon in general and Salem, certainly, because you have a lot of amenities here, whether it's healthcare or the core downtown's gotten a lot more vibrant and Opportunity Zone, I think, is going to only enhance that over the next few years. So yeah, I do think it'll net be a benefit for us.
Love it.
This is kind of shifting gears a little bit, but it's a super interesting conversation that I remember the first time I met you, you talked about this and then I just let it marinate in my mind, like this idea. And then I think you and I got coffee a couple of times and each time we meet, I always bring it up because I still can't wrap my head around it, but it's so fascinating and it's so, opposite of what I would initially think. So it's talking about stimulus and when we look at, you know, investing in just the government funneling just an astronomical amount of money into, you know, into the economy, initially you think like, hey, that's, you know, going to be a bad thing, right? And, you know, bad things are going to come. Inflation is one of them, obviously. Right. But I remember you saying the first time that, no, it's actually a monetary, like, it's a strategy. And initially in 2008, during the recession, it was a test. I think that's like the word that you used. Does that sound familiar? Do you know what I'm getting?
Yep.
What I'm saying? Can you dive into that? Because I think for our listeners, like, it's mind-blowing. Because, it's just the opposite of what you think.
Right. I mean, this was the great fear out of 08, 09 was all the money printing would create inflation. But I think what a lot of people don't realize is it's not the Federal Reserve that creates money in America today. Congress can. Clearly, stimulus was different. Because in 08, 09, it was just a financial exchanging bank reserves for treasuries, right? What I mean by that is the Federal Reserve, let's get a little wonky, so I may lose people here, but they literally can go on a computer, create a dollar on, you know, some digits, buy a treasury. But all you've done now is exchange with JP Morgan, for example, a treasury security for some bank reserves.
Okay.
Well, if JP Morgan doesn't go out and lend that into the economy because there's no loan demand, there's no business or consumer saying, hey, with that newly created reserve, you can lend out 90 cents of every dollar of that, right? That's how fractional reserve banking works. That's how you create money in the system because that's a multiplier, right? But if there's no demand for money, right, it just sits at the central bank as an excess reserve, i.e. not necessary, not used, right? This time's different. We did helicopter money, right? We literally printed checks and handed them to people in three different rounds, or PPP, you know, ultimately forgivable, was either spent or frankly pocketed by owners once it was forgiven. That's a different dynamic than parking an quote unquote excess reserve at JP Morgan and waiting for somebody to say, hey, I have fresh loan demand. Because the economic growth, you know, the sustainable economic growth of the economy doesn't really change. Right? Just because you print that money doesn't mean that there's some excess demand, there's some income that then demands expansion, some business that then demands that loan. That's the knock-on effect. So we never saw that. Right. And I think that's what we're learning now. And what we're learning this time is a different lesson. I mean, I could already see the economic papers being written today and they'll come out over the next few years as they get peer reviewed. And I think that there'll be a folly, in my opinion, that people say we'll never have a recession again. You just will only get better at understanding the output gap, you know, i.e. how much has GDP shrunk and where has it shrunk, and just plug the gap by handing out the money.
And see, and that's the part that just blew my mind was it completely changed my understanding. And I guess my understanding is very elementary, but like my view on the purpose of, you know, monetary policy and the way in which it's thought about by like the experts, and to them, it's a test, right?
Right.
And like, they're just continuing, like 2008 was a test and we were the only country that really had the means to do what we did by putting, what is it, 900 billion or something like that?
In 08, 09?
Yeah.
Well, it ended up being a few trillion dollars.
Oh, it was a few trillion.
Yeah, there was four different series of these experiments that had happened, right? But the initial bank bailout was around 900 billion.
Okay, yeah. That's what I was thinking. Yep. And so it's just fascinating now to look at it. And now, you know, these monetary experts are thinking like, no, this is the right thing to do. And do you think that, you know, say there is another recession in the future, or even a depression, something crazy. Do you think that they're just going to double down on the efforts that they did now, knowing that like there could be an effect, you know, on the on inflation and everything like that, but it's worth it in the end because it gets us out of a hole?
I don't know on the latter. I think yes on the former.
Okay.
And the reason I say no on the latter is I don't think they think that far. It's politics. Okay. It'll be the politicians that hand out the money.
Yeah.
And then honestly, they're just going to look at the Federal Reserve then to unfortunately monetize it.
Well, and what makes this recession too, I feel like just so much different, was because it was like a third party, the virus that created, you know, the hysteria, the, you know, the falling of the stock market, like all of this stuff, and the policies and politics that were in play to combat COVID with the shutdowns, the mandates, right, all those things, that created a change in consumer behavior as opposed to the economy by itself creating that change in consumer behavior. So I think that's an interesting dynamic too to look at.
Yeah, and this is another reason I don't think that in a year from now we'll be talking about inflation like we are. I think it will come back down. I mean, it will require us getting beyond the virus and fully reopening, right? And not just fully reopening from a policy, but from a mentality. People actually want to go and do these things and feel safe doing so. That's necessary. But what I really mean by that is that, you know, the run rate of this economy isn't what it was.
Yeah.
With stimulus in the system. It's somewhere back in the 1.5 to 2.5% area.
Okay.
And that's just demographics, labor force, et cetera. And so I think
can you give us a comparison so we kind of understand how it is different?
Yeah, so pre-COVID, the economy was growing at roughly speaking, 2%. Inflation was 2%. And the Fed funds rate was 2%. We found equilibrium at 2%. That's where we were. Inflation wasn't bubbling up. Everybody was pretty much fully employed. The unemployment rate was, 3.5%? Yeah. I think we'll get back to somewhere like that. And really, again, it's debt, demographics, technology, and globalization. Those are the big key trends. And if things don't change in those lines, this is why I don't think it'll be the 70s again. The 70s was a completely different demographic environment where you had a surging labor force participation rate, you had a growing population. We were much younger then. We didn't have the hangover we do with the baby boomers now that are going to retirement and taking their skill set with them. And it was a much more productive time, and there was much more demand for money, demand for goods. We were in build mode, not maintain mode. And I think by and large, other than housing today, we're more in maintain mode. It's just a different economic growth engine. And I think the analogy is it's better to look at the post-war 40s than the 70s. The 70s was a wage price spiral where there was just consistent excess demand over the year before for stuff and things. And again, if you look at labor force participation, long-term chart, you can look this up online, it was increasing. Women were entering the labor force, right? That was just a gigantic tailwind for demand. Mm-hmm. We just don't have that sans stimulus today. And so the post-40s had a spike in inflation. We don't talk about that like we talk about the 70s because it was much more like COVID. It was a retooling. This is more like war footing. We're fighting a virus, right? But after World War II, you had to retool the economy from war production to internal consumption.
Yeah.
There was a spike in inflation, a quick boost in output, and then things leveled back off, right?
And you saw that transition too with like, again, it's like a different era of technology, but you have like more home goods being created, like washers and dryers, and you have TVs and all these things. So that shift, I feel like, is easier in a sense. But as technology just increases to change now, you know, that demand is going to look different in, 5 years from now.
Right. Well, and I will say another thing that I believe will take the edge off of inflation in the next year or so is people don't talk enough yet about the pull forward of demand.
Explain that a little bit.
So in a nominal sense, so including inflation, just a price point sense, the purchase of durable goods surged at its peak like 35% above trend.
Okay.
During COVID. Well, if you redid your deck last year, you're not doing it again next year. If you bought a washer and dryer, you're probably not doing that for a handful of years at a minimum. Same with computers and technology. My personal life, my work life, we went on a buying spree because we had to adapt with work from home, and Zoom calls now are a thing where they weren't before. So that required an upfront investment. We're not going to do that for years. We put that behind us. And so now you look 1, 2, 3 years down the road, I just think you pulled forward a lot of demand. People aren't going to rebuy those. So you are likely to depress demand below trend for a number of years.
Interesting.
Okay. In a lot of these durable good categories, because you just don't need to do it again.
And you just bought them all. And a lot of that came with stimulus and everything like that.
100%. And working from home, the same dynamic. Yeah. All of a sudden you're at your home all the time. And you say, well, this kind of sucks. Or I actually need to fix that over there because it's just visible. Or even personally, all of a sudden my home office chair wasn't getting the job done. I wasn't really that price sensitive because I sit in the thing all day, every day. Yeah. I just needed that.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think going forward, I don't need that chair next year. I don't need to buy that. So I think that'll help take the edge off too. The question then is, does that cool the economy meaningfully? What is real demand going to be like if we have pulled forward growth? Especially in the scenario where you don't fully reopen or feel comfortable engaging services.
Yeah.
That's the danger going forward.
Interesting.
So I know our listeners are going to want to understand, and I'm curious as well, your perspective on crypto and how that's impacting the economy.
This is awesome.
So I want to share my perspective and you can tell me where I'm wrong and maybe where I'm getting some things right. But it seems like we have this, speaking of inflation, we're seeing all of that happen with the crypto world, where there are so many people that are just buying it and selling it, trying to make money, and really think that is the value that generally people will bring up is like, what do you mean there's no value? Look how much money I made buying and selling it last year, which is all fake demand, right? People aren't actually buying it to use it. They're buying it because they think they can sell it at a higher price. And so you see these just incredible curves on the value if you look at like Bitcoin and Ethereum and almost all of them.
Sure.
But I'm curious to hear your perspective on just, how it's impacting our economy and just where you think the future of it is.
I think it might actually start impacting our economy now that we've had a serious correction, especially because the ownership is concentrated in the 40-year-old and younger crowd. So that might hurt some consumption going forward, just from the psychology of, I thought I was a lot richer than I was. That wealth effect is a serious impact. If you cut the stock market in half tomorrow, you would see the economy start to cool because people feel less good about spending that incremental dollar, going out and having that nice bottle of wine, et cetera.
I actually saw a tweet recently where somebody was at Chipotle and they heard somebody comment, no guac today, Ethereum's down 20%. And I was like,
yeah, no, it, and there's a lot of funny jokes out there too, that this might cause some people who thought they were crypto experts and going to live off Bitcoin to now go back to work and kind of help that labor shortage. So let me just tell you a few things. I personally own some crypto. I've made it part of my personal portfolio. You know, this isn't investment advice. I have to say that as a professional investor, that, you know, do your own due diligence. It's extremely volatile. I'm not there to speculate. I do think 90% or more of what's out there in terms of these, there's like 9,000 coins out there or something, and probably 1,000 more by the time I said that. A lot of them are fraud. A lot of them are going to go to zero. And maybe even Bitcoin, Ethereum, the things we think are the winners now, might not be. Just like the tech revolution, a lot of, you know, where's Netscape now? Where's AOL? Mm-hmm. Those were the darlings. There's very few of them, Microsoft, et cetera, Intel, actually made it through. You know, they had a huge dip, of course. You know, Amazon at one point is down 95% from its, you know, all-time high before the 2000 crash, and it made it, clearly. So some will make it, most will not. Why I'm there is not the speculation. It's, you know, it's more about the, there's a real chance that this is kind of the new rails for banking, finance, you know, in my industry, trade settlement. You know, that's a trust game now. It could be trustless if you put it on a blockchain, whether that's Ethereum, whether it's a private blockchain. In fact, the SEC just this week approved only the 17th national exchange in America, and it's a blockchain-based settlement layer. So people will be able to do basically instantaneous stock settlement. I think that's fantastic. You know, I operate in the fixed income markets, and when you have a trade fail and you needed that $100 million, it's a problem. It's a problem for everyone. Blockchain can solve that. It's a technology. I view it as a technology. So I have some skin in the game because of that. I think the other thing too is I think it can help bank the unbanked and lower fees. Well, Visa and MasterCard, wonderful companies, but they're a pretty high tax on small business.
Huge.
Yeah, exactly. And so if you can take that 3 or 5% off the top for some of these folks and put this into a blockchain instantaneous settlement type of layer and reduce costs because it's technology. I think smart contracts are great too. You know, unfortunately, it'll disrupt employment. But for, you know, my famous example is insurance. You know, if I get in a car wreck and, you know, some adjuster looks at it, approves it, by the time I go to the approved, you know, repair shop and they say this is good, it'll just get processed through the smart chain. It's just a software. That's how you have to view some of these things. You don't need all these middlemen and people and paper pushing and mailing this thing around, 30-day delays. If you satisfy the contract, it can be instantaneous. You know, same with, you know, like settling real estate transactions. You know, they take 30 days to record at the mm-hmm. county. You know, these things could be just instantaneous, and title checks are, it's part of the blockchain. You can just look at it. So there's a lot of ways to reduce costs and friction. And I think that the current banking system, you know, JP Morgan, I don't mean pick on them, I should just say any bank, they don't really want somebody that doesn't have money because they're not going to make money off that person. So they either have to pay exorbitant fees or go to Walmart to get their check cash, pay a fee. And there is a real chance that this technology can eliminate a lot of that cost and friction and let these people have a more secure banking environment and reduce fees, because the people with the least amount of money pay the most in that system. And that's tough. And I think it's a technology that can help that. Might be more than you wanted in the answer.
No, I love that. Thank you so much.
It's a very fascinating space to me.
Is there, how does the government get involved in a healthy manner with crypto? Because a lot of people are trying different things. I'm kind of curious to hear where you're at with it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm for regulation, but I'm not for heavy-handed regulation. I think that it'd be smart for them to say, well, we need to protect consumers, because again, I do think a lot of it's fraudulent out there. But how do you let innovation happen? Because that has always been why America's had a better, more resilient economy than even, say, Europe, is we just tend to let innovation go and capture it, use it, harness it, don't squash it. So how to do that, I think that's a really tough balancing act going forward. But, you know, I hope that they can understand the benefits, and there's going to be some uglies along the way. But we've also had Enron and WorldCom. Yep. We've had some massive frauds that have been in broad public daylight that have gone on for decades. So, you know, I hope that they're balanced in their view and realize that this has a potential. And if it does, it'll be a thing. If well regulated, if it not, it'll peter out on its own. No threat to you is kind of my view. But I hope that's the balance they take.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see. I don't know what industry won't be disrupted by smart contracts when you don't need to have that middle person employed to do this job of just transactional. It just happens automatically. I think like real estate, you brought up insurance, like all of these industries could be massively disrupted. But
I agree.
I think every time there's innovation, there's all these new opportunities that come with it. I think the problem is a lot of these opportunities don't have to be local. Like you don't need an insurance guy in Salem. You can have somebody that is creating code in India that would probably do a better job for like a quarter of the price. And I don't know how local economies kind of provide guardrails, but make sure that, you know, there are opportunities.
Yeah. I mean, you just have to find where's your spot in the value chain and how do you use it. But I think that's why you need to always be, especially going forward. I think COVID accelerated disruption. It didn't make it go away. So you just always have to think, what are the risks to my position personally, professionally, my business? Is this something you could take advantage of or guard against or pivot away from if you think it's going to hit you? I just think those things are going to accelerate going forward. It's a real risk.
I love it. Get on Twitter. That's where all the kids are talking about what they're learning right now. I think that's like the best tool to learn from 20-year-olds and the kids that are just like thinking outside of the box, and especially with crypto, NFTs, and like some things that can happen there.
Yep.
I got one more quick question before we do over the hot seat. This question kept coming to my mind, and it was something that you said earlier that triggered this thought. But when you bring up the, you know, that shift in service, like hard product, economy, and that shift about 5%.
Yep.
From a policy perspective, to create a more resilient, stable, and efficient supply chain, what things can like state governments, federal governments be looking to invest in or do? What policies would help secure that? Like innovation investment in ports, in, you know, what is it? Because it's something in my mind in the realm of politics. I'm thinking like, where do you help assist that supply chain issue?
Boy, this is real idealistic, not realistic.
Yeah.
But I would say don't be reactionary to what has just happened to you, i.e. the logistical capacities you just mentioned, because frankly, you largely created that by overstimulating the economy while it was shut down. I hope that's the lesson. I'm doubtful it is, because you had a Republican and a Democrat in the White House that both handed out money, right? Mm-hmm. And so now I think that the memory will be very front and center. Next time we hit a bump in the road, that where's my handout? Mm-hmm. They did it. You better pony up and find the political will. So I think we're more vulnerable probably to those shocks going forward. So from a policy standpoint, I would just say, please don't hand out money that's not needed. From a humanitarian side, yeah, if you shut down the economy and said you can no longer do what's lawfully what causes you to put food on the table and pay for your rent, you should plug the gap because you created it.
Yeah.
You didn't let them balance the risk and take the risk on their own. But just the free handouts are just a terrible idea. I would say that's the policy. I'd say from the corporate side, though, I think there's a lot of awakening. I got my MBA a few years back, and just the lean inventory just in time, that was so hot for 30 years, and it just got laid waste to the vulnerability that now you're going to go the other direction probably. Instead of just in time, it's just in case. Mm-hmm. I better have some inventory around because I can never predict what's going to happen, and I can't have this happen again because it's a real, you know, market share issue if I can't satisfy my customer going forward. So I think that's more on the corporate side and might be a little bit less profitability or new challenge for them, but I think it's going to be necessary going forward.
Okay. Fascinating answer. Mind-blowing, huh?
It's great. This is great. Thank you so much for being here, Garrett. I'm learning a ton.
Yeah,
our audience will find a ton of value from this as well. But now it's time for the hot seat. So this is a game we invented live on the podcast. The last episode, we created it on the spot. So all three of us will have an opportunity to ask a question. It can be anything. And then we all have to answer the question. So even the question you ask, you'll be answering.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have one, Zach?
I'm just going to use the same one I always use. We'll have you go last. You have time to think about a question.
But then we can't answer it if you ask the same one because we already answered the question.
Oh, that's a good point. Okay, then you go first.
You go first. Okay. What is a mistake that you continue to make throughout your life?
you know, it's just natural in my industry. It's the kind of recency bias or anchoring. It's so hard to it's a great book, Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow, mm-hmm. by Daniel Kahneman. I urge everyone to read it. It's not a finance book. It's a life book, but it's so easy to look at what has just happened and project it forward. And in my industry, that's very easy to do and just got turned on its head really hard in COVID. So I just try to be very open and listen to countering thoughts and constantly think, why am I wrong? Should I change my opinion? And I think that's just really hard as a human.
Awesome. That's great. Thank you.
Interesting. I got to answer that one now.
Yeah.
I think one of the mistakes I always make is I get overzealous with like my tasks that I need to do. And I just continue to take stuff on. So I procrastinate. And part of my procrastination is based off this idea of like, okay, this is going to take a lot of time. Like, this is going to be annoying. And then I do the thing and it's fine. But, and I just continuously make that. I procrastinate kind of the easier things thinking they're going to be harder. And it's always vice versa. So it's for me, I need to like, it's always working on being, you know, prioritizing the right things and not being overzealous.
Yeah, I totally connect with that. Just like, I know this is going to take me 10 minutes to get done, but like everything about me is pulling me away from it to go do something else. I think for me, mine is, it's kind of related, but just starting new things. Like I am always so excited for something new to like, what can I learn from this? Like what will happen if we get started? But finishing things is not as exciting for me personally. Like I don't get a lot of fulfillment out of getting something done. I get it out of getting things started. And so I'm definitely much better about mitigating that. And I have people that I talk to before I will commit to something to kind of help me think through it and understand the impacts. But yeah, for me, it's still, it's a challenge. Like something's new, shiny, like I want to start, let's go. So, all right, Zach, you got one? I brought this box of random questions.
Let me pick one out of here. So I got a couple.
The random question
the
box.
Icebreaker or the colors mean something different?
It probably does. I haven't looked into it yet.
Oh, this is actually interesting. When you were younger, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Archaeologist.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So I got the bug as a kid with Indiana Jones. And I seriously almost went to George Washington University and went that route. And then it was just, I'll never forget my dad. Like, well, what kind of job are you going to get after that? I mean, not everybody's digging up artifacts. It's, have you thought about that? And then that just kind of put a little monkey wrench in the plan.
Dang. What about you?
I think a basketball player. I feel like that was my my thing. I wanted to be a Portland Trailblazer as a kid. I'm trying to think of if there's another one that I was really passionate about, but basketball was like my entire life growing up, like social life, like every part of everything I did was based around basketball.
Okay. You got a basketball hoop in your backyard now too.
We do. Yeah.
It's funny. This is a really funny question. So at any point in my life from probably about age 4 to, I don't know, probably in college, I always had this idea of like, this is what I want to be when I grow up. And I'd always have a path like this is how I'm going to get there. Right. These are my stepping stones. So my mind's changed like literally 1,000 times. Like there's a point I want to be a cardiologist because my dad had a congenital heart disease. And there's a point I want to be an NFL quarterback. Like I want to be in the art. Like it's changed a million times. But probably the funniest thing, the one that I remember most of me getting so passionate about it, I wanted to be a snake hunter. So I watched like the Animal Channel a lot, right? And they'd like have these shows on snakes. And I thought it was so cool. I actually... going through, you know, after my dad passed, like we're going through a bunch of stuff of like what he saved. And I found like 5 little cards, like badges that I made, like with crayon. And then I would tape over it. So it's like hard, right?
Yeah.
And it was like Zach Snake Hunter. And yes. I'd draw a little snake on it. So I'll have to bring those in and show you. But that's probably the funniest one. And Taylor always, you know, she still laughs about that.
Yeah.
So
yeah. That's awesome.
I'm terrified of snakes.
Oh, yeah. See, that's the thing is I am too now. Like I hate snakes. I'm not a snake guy. So, but, you know, you told me that when I was, you know, 5 years old. You want to pull one out or do you have one?
Yeah, I'm going to go with one off the heads here. So, looking back at the whatever 2 years of COVID and the disruption of life, what's the one thing that surprised you most about your personal life experience in that time period?
Yeah, I think for me, how oblivious I was to the people around me. I kind of live my life with like rose-colored glasses and like things are fine. And I even would tell people like, it's actually been a pretty good year for me. But it wasn't. Like there's a lot of like really bad things happening. I mean, there's different degrees of bad. Like my life wasn't completely falling apart, but there were definitely some people that are very important to me that had very real needs that I was oblivious to. And I think for me, it just kind of forced me to realize that it's okay and it's actually more productive to just be aware of reality as opposed to like, things are going to be great. Like everything's fine. So, yep. Good question.
That's a really good question. This probably sounds dumb how like I can't think of one thing specifically right off the top of my head. Can you ask it one more time?
Yeah. So looking back at the 2-year-ish time frame of COVID and the life disruption, what surprised you most personally speaking about how you felt or how you engaged kind of that time period?
Oh my gosh. This is a really hard question for some reason for me.
I think how about this? Want me to take it? You can think for a second?
Yeah.
I think for me, it was kind of jumping off the not the rat race, but I was in such a routine of get up, get dressed, go to the office, come home, get a workout in, get the kids or whatever. And it just really smacked me of, whoa, what am I doing here? What's this all leading to? And is this what I want? And kind of some life choice. I wouldn't say anything profound's come out of it yet, but I think kind of a bit of a awakening or awareness of way to take care. Is time just slipping by and I'm just
interesting
going through the motions.
Actually, I didn't think of one. I did think of one. It was patience. I've always been kind of an impatient person for the most part. Like when I want something, like I want it now. But I think COVID exacerbated my like understanding of that and has kind of like calmed that down. My wife and I were supposed to get married in May of 2020 and we had to postpone 4 times or 3 times. We got married on the 4th time. So like those kind of things of just knowing like there's a lot of things that are just truly outside of my control that I can't control. And, you know, with patience, that's a huge part of it. So just learning how to like understand, you know, to be calm when I'm being impatient, like it's out of my control. I can't change it. Just like live with the reality that it is and don't let it frustrate you.
Right.
It's probably the biggest thing.
Love it. I want to ask your one question to Garrett.
The one I always ask.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What do you, and this would be a really interesting answer too, considering the work that you do. What motivates you more, the thrill of victory or the agony of defeat?
Oh, I would have to say in my line of work, it's the agony of defeat. Yeah. And that's
what I think.
Well, I think it's solely because I work in fixed income.
Yeah.
Right. You grow up in a downside mentality. I'm not personally, I love investing in equities and growth equities. That's my personal calling, but at work, I just can't mess up.
Yeah.
The upside's known, the downside's a lot.
Yeah. 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 And that's like in my head, I was even thinking, you know, if say like you're a stockbroker, you know, for general understanding, like you can hit it big. And that could be exciting, but it's worse to like lose just a ton of money. And in your field, it's even a little bit more different and like has a lot more repercussions.
Right.
So,
right.
Interesting.
Awesome. Well, we are big on this podcast to making sure people know how much they are valued and how much we appreciate them. So thank you so much for the hard work you're doing in coming to this podcast and sharing your wisdom and insights with our community. We really do appreciate it, Garrett.
Great. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Yes. Thank you, Garrett.
You just got done listening to the Salem Emerging Leader podcast, and we appreciate it. If you look in the show notes, you will find a link. If you click on that link, you'll be able to subscribe to the Salem Emerging Leader newsletter. We want you to be in touch with all the incredible things that are happening in this city because of people like you. We appreciate you. I hope you have a good day.